Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello and welcome to the How To Academy podcast, the bi-weekly show from London's home of big thinking. I'm Vas Christodoulou. My guest on this episode, Tom Chatfield, is a writer and philosopher whose new book, Wise Animals, offers an account of our deep history with technology and asks what that history can teach us about how to navigate the complexities of the digital world. I sat down with him last week to find out more. Tom, your new book is called Wise Animals. Who are the wise animals? Regular listeners to this show might be surprised to find that for once we're not about to talk about elephants or octopuses or something like that.
So we are the wise animals, and we're also the unwise animals. And I guess using that word was important to me because wisdom suggests something more than just intelligence or smartness. It suggests both having intelligence and using it well, and thinking about the purposes, thinking about the why and the wherefore. And I guess the root argument is that if you look at our species, all the wonderful and terrible things we can do, the question is what should we do, and how should we think about our own amazing intellectual and technological capabilities? And those questions seem really urgent to me. The enormous amount of power we have at our fingertips to use it wisely, to use it critically, to think beyond just what we can do this and we're terribly clever, and to try and root our understanding of ourselves in something more rich and humane rather than just smart.
Yeah, and what we're really talking about here is humanity's relationship to technology. Give us a potted history of your own relationship to technology from childhood to the present before we talk about humanity's relationship to technology.
So for me, I always describe myself as, you know, a kind of interdisciplinary geek, I guess. So my academic background, my degrees were kind of literature with a bit of philosophy thrown in. I did an undergrad and a master's and a doctorate. But I was always a geek who loved coding, who loved playing around on BBC Micros and playing music and doing maths. And I guess from a very young age, I wanted to make connections between these things. I loved technology, video games in the 1980s and 1990s. People were building these sort of new worlds. The potential seemed limitless. But at the same time, I loved literature and stories and art and myths and creativity. And it also seemed that all of this old, wonderful, interesting stuff was going to be utterly transformed by the new. But the way that a lot of people talked about the new stuff was really shallow and deaf to the philosophical and the literary and the mythological and even the spiritual. And so as I got older and kind of got to do my own thing, I wrote a book about video games as my first book because I was obsessed with games. I thought they were astonishingly compelling. I thought they mapped the future. This is just over a decade ago. And I thought people weren't writing about them seriously and what they told us about ourselves. And then I followed that with books about critical thinking, about what it means to think well, books about technology and language, books about, I suppose, technology and ethics. And it led me to this place where I just found myself doing a lot of work and talking and thinking around this vague idea. How do we use technology well? How do we think about it more richly and humanely? How do we overcome false consciousness? Along the way, I became a parent, and that's been huge for me. I have two kids who are now 8 and 10, and just raising two little human beings and worrying about technology and watching them you know, come into this human inheritance of culture and language and technology and society, and realizing that this relationship between the generations, how we hand on and build and rebuild all that we have, this is the defining dynamic, very obviously, in human life and human existence. And again, it's just not centered for me in so many discussions of technology and what we ought to be doing and how we ought to be using it. Tech companies are obsessed with, you know, kind of men who are middle-aged geeks who buy stuff. And that's such a small part of the human story and such a kind of shallow way of talking about technology in its kind of wider and deeper sense. So I find this stuff fascinating. I guess I just continue to run around after things that interest me and try to help other people have richer conversations and challenge preconceived ideas around it.
How do you mediate between your kids and the technology that demands their attention?
Badly. No, I mean, there is that thing, you know, the attention, those who conspire to kind of command and shape our attention in a way of trying to mold our thoughts, that which you pay attention to becomes your life. So I think I'm very aware. For me, the first thing is the context, right? It's not just about technology, children, oh, I'm so worried. Just much more generally, the spaces we're in, the environments, you know, movement, food, drink, exercise, the built environment, nature, this fairly obviously profoundly affects our thinking. It affects our bodies. We're not brains in vats. We're not just a pair of tapping fingers and some eyeballs. We're embodied beings. You see this with children. I've written books for children, in fact. I've written about neurodiversity, which is a subject of interest to me because my son and I are not kind of wholly neurotypical. And you just see again and again and again that if you want to describe someone's thinking, you need to talk about their body, their breathing, their situation, where they are, who they're with. Technology is a part of this. The built environment's a part of this, but it's not the whole story. So I guess with my children, we try to look at what it means to have good conversations about technology, what it means to use it well, what it means to balance it with movement, with human interactions, with other kinds of fun and play, just what it means to have a variety of types and textures of attention and time and activity in your life, and what's good for them and what works for them, and desperately trying to help them develop this skill of critical engagement and discernment. It's not that technology is bad, it's not that they shouldn't be using it. It's that in this day and age, you know, you need to try and have a kind of a literacy, a critical literacy, some self-control, some self-awareness. So you just need to keep on talking about it and thinking about it and not pretending all the bad stuff is about technology, all the good stuff is about technology, seeing it as part of the human-made world that surrounds us.
How do you, middle-aged geek, target of the Silicon Valley tech companies, decide what technology you're going to adopt in your own life and which technology you're going to reject?
So I'm inspired by the Amish here, who get a bad rap when it comes to technology, maybe for some good reasons, but they practice a principle of almost putting a technology in trial before they adopt it. And depending on the Amish community, and some of them use quite a bit of technology, you know, they're selective rather than just outright rejective. But you look at what it offers. And you look at the kind of values bound up with it, you look at the kind of behaviors it will engineer, and you try to ask, in a way, what do I want? What does this technology want from me? And is that balance and is that bargain one that I wish to bring into my life? So I'm pretty selective in my use of tech. I mean, I'm on social media, but I try to be on it very little. I don't have the apps on my phone. I try to use it selectively for purposes that I understand well. Doom scrolling is one of the great words of our age. It describes this idea that you're just almost sort of trapped in this dark pattern, this loop of quiet despair / titillation / anger, where you just, you know, the endless interface sucks you in. And so I try to be very aware about the fact that fundamentally I'm weak and I'm flawed. And if I'm going to achieve stuff and be my best self or my least worst self, I can't just sort of sit there relying on willpower. I have to get myself into different places physically with different people and do activities and plan through activities that bring out the best in me. Go for a run, go for a walk, spend time with my kids and put my own phone off so that I model some attention to them. And then play Super Smash Brothers with my kids and get into that. And then say at 7 o'clock we're going to have screens off and so on. So there's no magic here. But there is this just central idea that there has to be a negotiation. and that you can only have a meaningful negotiation if you've had some thinking about your own needs, your own vulnerabilities, what's being offered to you, what's being kind of withheld and advanced by different technologies. And very broadly, I guess, some of the best technologies in my life are things like books and pianos, in my case, because what a book offers is a kind of wonderful, noise-free, single-purpose, off-screen, no batteries required, natural light, embracing interaction with detailed long-form thought. I read a lot of books and try not to read too much short-form stuff because, for me, that's partly about signal and noise and calming myself. I'll play the piano a lot, just because it's something I love. A piano is a wonderful, you know, haptic, tactile experience. It's a great, beautiful piece of technology for making music. I make music with my children and my friends. I don't always get it right, but it's this idea of this informed negotiation. Crucially, I guess, all of us are very constrained by circumstances, by money, by society, by economics, by peer pressure. And so in the larger scheme of things, it's not just a matter of personal consumer choice. The negotiations that really matter are difficult and collective. Those are the ones that count most of all in the long term. And I think one of the themes of the book for me is what kind of frameworks, what kind of ways of thinking can help us enter into these collective incremental negotiations and get out of the mindset where we're passive, we're victims. Ultimately, technology is just determining the course of the world and we're just along for the ride.
What separates a technology from a tool? Is a screwdriver a technology?
So this is a nice simple one in some ways. The distinction I make in the book is that plenty of other animals use tools. You know, crows are pretty adept at fastening things like hooks out of leaves to get hold of insects they want to eat. Apes will use sticks and stones to bash things. Octopuses, those wonderful animals, will find coconut shells and clean them out underwater and then use them to kind of hide in sort of armor. So this is the opportune use of an environment's offerings at all. You can kind of pick up a rock, and 3 million years ago, we've got very good evidence that ancestors so ancient they didn't even belong to our genus were doing this, Australopiths in Africa. So a technology, when does a tool become a technology? There's this threshold, which is gradual, and has only happened in the case of our species and our ancestors. And that's when, instead of just making opportune use of the environment, you start to, between individuals and between generations, have a body of knowledge that gradually refines and remembers and crafts and improves tools over time. So a technological culture is fundamentally communal, taught, learned, and intergenerational. And we see this in stone tools over a period of a million years or more. Stones that are sharpened crudely start to become these things known as hand axes, which are shaped a bit like teardrops. They perfectly fit our hands. They look weirdly like mobile phones in the sense of the way they slot into the hand. They were crafted with the aid of secondary tools. They were often flaked from things like obsidian, which is really hard to cut and is deposited in volcanic areas. It can be quite hard to find and craft. And so gradually, we see in our ancient ancestors, somehow, the capability not just to make use of an environment's offerings opportunistically, but to iterate and improve and teach and have secondary tools and have this culture of improvement. And so a technology ultimately then is something that evolves alongside us. Language is an intellectual technology. It's handed down, improved, iterated. And the co-evolution of humanity and technology is the key focus of my book. It's the story, I guess, I want to tell that I think can help us understand the present more richly. A screwdriver is absolutely a technology. It's made of metal and it's made of plastic and it fits into screws in different designs. It's reliant upon literally thousands of years of incremental discovery, invention, testing, iteration, and learning. It looks simple, and yet, in the sense in which I mean it, it could only conceivably exist as part of the technological culture of a species that has spent centuries iteratively improving, investigating, learning, and evolving these things alongside it.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Marquee TV. Marquee TV is an incredible streaming service that is a gateway to arts and culture. With my subscription, I've enjoyed watching some of the Royal Shakespeare Company's most acclaimed productions of recent years, including David Tennant in Richard II and Simon Russell Beale in The Tempest. I've seen multiple productions of The Ring Cycle and Thelonious Monk playing in Brussels in 1963. I've watched Alice in Wonderland at the Royal Opera House and Giselle at La Scala. Marquee TV really is the most accessible way into culture I've ever encountered, and a treasure trove for any arts lover. You can try it for 3 months for just 99p. Yep, 3 months for 99p with the code HOWTO. Just visit marquee.tv and use the promo code HOWTO to dive into the world of the arts like never before.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
You debunk a lot of myths about technology in this book. And I think the central one is that technologies are not simply tools to extend human agency. They have their own values, even their own wants, as well as their own effects on what human beings are. So let's explore those ideas in a bit more depth. What would be a pre-digital age technology that came with its own values and wants and acted in a particular way on our nature?
So I'm echoing the great historian of technology, Melvin Kranzberg, here, who said, there are no neutral tools. And he meant something by this that I think is very, very important. And as you say, it's universal. It's simply that if you create a technology or a tool, a technological culture produces artifacts. Each of these artifacts has certain affordances, certain tendencies. It makes some things easier. It facilitates certain kinds of action. And it makes other kinds of action harder or more difficult or less available. Let's take a spear, right? Now, if I am holding a spear, if I'm holding a long stick with a sharp stone, a sharpened stone fastened to it at the end by glue and twine, for example, which is a pretty complicated technology. You need fires for heat treatment. You need multiple materials. You don't just, monkeys don't make these. Only humans have made these. If I'm holding a spear, then me plus the spear, or me and my mates plus the spear, can now start to kill big animals at a distance. We can also perhaps start to kill other hominins who don't have spears. And so suddenly, the options available to us in terms of hunting, in terms of defense, in terms of aggression, in terms of our ability to interact with the world, suddenly we are extended in particular directions. I'm holding a spear. And of course, if I'm holding a spear, right, I'm not holding a pen or a brush. I'm in a different mode. So these are the kind of biases and tendencies and affordances built into technology, and they're everywhere. You know, writing has been, you know, utterly, utterly, utterly transformative for our species, fairly obviously. But what it affords, what it quote-unquote wants us to do, is to pass on knowledge between generations, between different times and places. It allowed monarchs to have codes of law. It allowed there to be much more sophisticated encoding of property and possessions and trade to tally goods and exchange, a balance sheet, an interest sheet. Suddenly, when you have numeracy and literacy, you can have lending and interest. You can have monarchs and codes of law. You can have religions that are codified in this complex way. Now, this stuff is really complicated. There's not one thing it does. But as a pressure upon us, it is absolutely transformative upon our lives and societies. Marshall McLuhan put it very well. He said the medium is the message. And what he meant by this is that when you look at television or television supported by advertising or radio or whatever, the actual form of the medium, that it is a mass medium, that a million or 100 million people in their homes can see these moving talking pictures, that in itself, the very fact of that, is a transformative and powerful force that will push society and people in certain directions. Not simple directions, not one direction, but it creates the possibilities, for example, for mass watching of sporting events. The first event in history that was watched by more people remotely than in person was a boxing match. It was listened to, in New York City near the turn of the century. And the wireless radio allowed the broadcast of this match to a larger audience outside the arena in Hoboken, New Jersey, then in it, there was such a thing as a commentator. That wasn't a job before. That's absolutely miraculous. We take it for granted now. And what I want to do is not say that technology is good or bad in a simple way, but it's to just make this point that although we don't notice it, every one of the technologies that has accrued and been invented and developed over time has brought new behaviors, new kinds of thinking, new possibilities of action and interaction with it. And these have profoundly changed what it means to be human, how we relate to each other, how we relate to the world. And this is normal. The story of our species is the story of these changes. Change is the story of us. There is no such thing as us without technology. Technology predates our species by millennia, by millions of years. Fires, shelters, carriers, containers, weapons. These allowed Homo sapiens to exist in the first place, to be this vulnerable, cooperative, changeable, brilliant species that we are.
When I used the word myth earlier, I meant it in the sense of a false belief. But there are myths of the present age that are myths in the other sense of the word, powerful stories that speak to the zeitgeist. And three of the interlocking myths that are prevalent in Silicon Valley at the moment are the singularity, artificial superintelligence, and post-human immortality. So can you explain to the less nerdy listeners what these are and what their relationship is, and whether there's any sense in which they're remotely plausible? If not, why are they so widely discussed?
So I think these are myths in the old-fashioned sense of stories of enormous significance that have to do with our kind of sense-making and our beliefs about the world. I think there's a lot of truth in them, but I think to take them just literally is the least interesting thing we can do with such stories. So to take them in order, the story of the singularity comes directly from science fiction. It's literally lifted out of science fiction novels, and it describes a point of no return, an event horizon for our species, where beyond this point, technology in the form of artificial intelligence and superintelligence becomes self-making and self-improving. It's a tipping point, in other words. At some point, perhaps in the near future, where you create a system so smart and with sufficient autonomy and self-awareness that it then improves itself or creates an even smarter system. And then that creates an even smarter system. And that even smarter system, it's smarter than us. It's smarter than our ability to control it. It's smarter than our ability to comprehend it. So there's this feedback loop, this tipping point, this point of no return. And once this has happened, there is no going back. And then potentially everything changes. You know, problems are solved in ways we can't even comprehend. Control is taken away from us. Maybe it's a super intelligent, benevolent deity. Maybe it's malevolent. And the moment, of course, you go down this rabbit hole, you really start to think, well, in that case, the most important question facing humanity, bar none, is how can we create one of these things that likes us, that wants to look after us and our planet, rather than accidentally or on purpose to destroy us? There are other questions too. Has this already happened? Did it happen a long time ago when we're in a simulation being run by one of these things, an ancestor simulation? And this stuff can sound crazy, but of course it's tied into very real facts. Exponential rates of accelerating returns upon computation and so on. What's going on in AI right now would have seemed genuinely miraculous, even kind of 10 or 15 years ago. And so transhumanism and posthumanism are the related idea that there will come a point when our ability to improve and change ourselves and what it means to be human by, for example, genetic engineering, by interfaces between humans and computers, between brains and computers, our ability to augment our own mental and physical capacities. This will happen at such a rate and to such a degree that there will again be, if you like, a point of no return or a kind of evolutionary fire break between historic, fundamentally biological humans and post-humans, transhumans, who've become something else. A new, they're still human in some senses, but in other senses, they are to a present human what we are to an Australopith, to a, you know, a kind of ape-like ancestor from 3 million years ago. And I guess, as you can see, there's an awful lot of truth in these stories, because they're stories about the accelerating returns of technology, its profound transformations of our world and what it means to be human, the huge hazards bound up with this, the idea that there are tipping points and points of no return in history, and I guess the idea that we have always and immemorially transformed and augmented ourselves and changed, and will continue to do so, and that we're able to build systems that are staggeringly smart in inhuman ways. The problem for me, and the thing that makes them atavistic or mythological, is that I think they kind of ultimately choose to dwell upon imagined problems and solutions and hypothetical conclusions and reason back from these, rather than real, specific, actual, particular problems. We've always transformed ourselves through technology and will continue to do so. But this doesn't, I think, mean that being human has changed, because being human has always been about change. And I don't think that any kind of superhuman entity or power is poised to dissolve our problems or save us from ourselves. I also think it would be very dangerous to think about this in several ways. If, for a start, you believe that there's one supreme goal for our species, creating an artificial superintelligence, and it will solve all other problems, then implicit in that is the idea that pretty much every other present worry and negotiation is irrelevant, that getting to that point as fast as possible, as unencumbered as possible by hand-wringing and so on, is a supreme goal for humanity. So rich people and smart people should just be left to get on with it on behalf of everybody else. And maybe indeed, because it can redeem all past and present losses and injustices, you don't need to care about the other stuff. You don't need to care about bias and exclusion and historical injustice and present inequality. You can, so to speak, invent your way out of it. Now, as it happens, I do believe that it's through innovations and invention that we are, I hope, going to be able to deal with the massive present challenges of our planet. But for me, the crucial model for doing this effectively is one that brings more different perspectives into the rooms where these things are debated, that is more alert to the exclusions and injustices embedded in data and history, that is more kind of humble, that has more ethical humility, and that absolutely takes as its starting position that we need doubt to be built into these systems. We cannot afford to assume we're right, that the future is a set path, or that we're going to be saved from ourselves. And I think also, although I'm less confident about this one, that even if we create super intelligent machines in the sense that they are super powered in certain dimensions, I don't think they will be minds. And I do think that it's much more important to look at the incentives of the companies controlling them, to see them as part of the world as it is now, with all its structures of power and energy and infrastructure and exploitation and justice and injustice and governance, in a way to double down on the boring stuff of good governance, of oversight, of the discussion of values and purposes in a way that's respectful and alert to the present realities of the world, rather than, as is so tempting, heading towards some rapture of the nerds that dissolves everything into a glorious, detail-free tale of transcendence.
What advice would you give to teenagers listening to this who want to survive and thrive in an age when AI seems poised to eat away at so much of culture? And is it the same advice you'd give to their parents who are worrying about those questions for themselves?
I think there's some old advice, really. Don't be disheartened. The meanings we make aren't about how fast we travel towards a particular destination. We make the meanings for ourselves by dialogue, by talking to one another and listening. The purpose of you, the purpose of a human life, is not one thing. The purpose of a life is bound up with the relationships we have with others, with the world, with beauty, with skill. Once you've got enough of something, it's about deepening and thickening and exploring and practicing things that make life worthwhile to you. And I think pragmatically, when it comes to technology, we're surrounded by ever smarter systems that can endlessly and instantly answer any question, that can do things at superhuman speed with superhuman fluency. But deciding which questions are worth answering in the first place is a matter for us. Values, purposes, and intentions reside with us. If you want to double down on human skills that will make you employable and, I think, help you live a happier and richer life, it's these skills of critical thought, of communication, of empathy, of questioning, of reframing, that I think are the most empowering. the tools we're creating in economic terms can absolutely be rivalrous to us, can hollow out certain careers and options and so on. But I think in a more fundamental sense, they're nothing like us. You are not like a machine, and a machine is not like you. To be an embodied, sociable animal living alongside other brilliant, embodied, sociable animals is utterly different. There's nothing it's like to be an AI. They're just tools. So talk to others, listen to others, tell the stories, ask the questions, interrogate what it means to be alive now, and don't succumb to the delusion of thinking yourself imperfect or that you're some kind of broken machine that needs to be optimized in order to find a place in the world.
In what sense is Wise Animals a book about love?
I guess in the sense that matters most of all, because I'm with people like the philosopher Virginia Held or the philosopher David Weinberger, who writes very beautifully about the ethics of technology. Without caring concern for other human beings, there can be no morality or ethics. The word love is not used a lot in contexts such as that of technology. But if you want to talk about our species and our survival and the evolutionary strategies that have got us to this point and that I think we're going to need to be literate in and aware of if we want to get to a future point, ultimately, love in its many forms of parents for children, of children for parents, the love that exists between generations and kin and non-kin, love of learning, love of knowledge, love of beauty. These are the drives that we have. We don't do stuff just because we want a number to go up or because we want to win. That's almost incidental. Without loving care for others, none of the rest follows or means anything. And also, for me, it's love that teaches us to let go, to care about the future and others, to set ourselves aside. I tell a philosophical story in the book, a thought experiment about what would happen if you knew with certainty that the world would be destroyed the moment after your death. Would that affect how you feel about your life, about the world, about anything? Most people, when presented with this question, say, well, yes, it would. If I genuinely knew that the second after I died, the world would be annihilated, this would be perhaps one of the most appalling things I could possibly know. It would hollow out the value of so much else in my life. And yet, in an egotistical sense, something that by definition you won't and cannot experience, it's hard to see how that can affect you. It can have no effect upon your pleasure and pain, because by definition, at the moment of your death, the sum total of your pleasures and pains will come to a giant full stop. And this is a parable told by the philosopher Samuel Scheffler. And he makes the point that actually the lesson of this story, I think for a lot of people, is not that, well, okay, it's fine if the world gets destroyed, actually, I see that, who cares? It's that the value of almost everything we care about is bound up with some belief in its continuity after we're gone. The continuity, not just of our bloodline, you don't have to have children. The continuity of humanity, of human potential, of our loves, of our learning, of our intellect, of our technologies, of other things we find beautiful, of the earth in all its fecundity and variety. Egotism actually is really rubbish as an account of value and meaning and purpose. It's just a really inadequate, silly account of what it is to be human. It just doesn't hold water when you think about it. All of us, dependency, we're born into utter dependency upon others. Everything we have and do is given to us through others. We're sick, we age, we die, we wish to leave things behind. None of this is really explicable in terms of just maximizing my personal little pleasure quotient of good, happy stuff. It's that vaster identification, that care, and the extension of our capacity for care beyond ourselves that almost defines, I think, human progress and a life worth living.
It's a profound point on which to end. Tom Chatfield, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This episode starred Tom Chatfield and was produced and presented by me, Vas Christodoulou. I make the show with Nicole Wong and editor John Doughty. Until next time, thanks for listening.